I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer, reporting from the University of Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. Come along and join me for a visit with Dennis Brown.
Hi, I'm Dennis Brown. I'm the Assistant Vice President for News and Media Relations and University Spokesman at Notre Dame. We're here in the Morris Inn Campus Hotel, right on the campus of the university.
You've been here long enough to fall in love with the place, or you wouldn't still be here.
Yeah, I've been here for 31 years, and as you said, it's been a place that has really been a rewarding experience. And the university is it's just one of the really distinctive places in America and in higher education, and really enjoyed every moment of it.
The name Notre Dame, Fighting Irish, it's like mythological, you know, it's a lot bigger than the reality in some ways. For example, you asked me how many students are here, and I thought, oh, 20,000, and you said?
Actually, our undergraduate student population is usually right around 8,600, 8,700. We're a little higher right now. Yeah, it has a massive national reputation for both academic excellence as well as the athletic traditions. And yet, it's a small community in relative terms. And that's one of the reasons why our alumni are so loyal to the place.
Let's talk football for a moment. Can't help that. That's so cool.
Yeah, the Notre Dame football tradition started more than 100 years ago, but really came to the fore in 1912 when Newt Rockne was a student and a wide receiver on the football team, and he and our quarterback, they didn't invent the forward pass, but they revolutionized it and made it popular in a very historic game at Yankee Stadium against Army. And then Rockne went on to become the coach in 1918 and won multiple national championships in the 1920s and really put the university on the map. But over time, the academic excellence caught up to the athletic tradition, and it's really one of the great combinations in higher education today.
What are some of the more outstanding majors that people seek out going to Notre Dame because?
Not surprisingly, our theology and philosophy departments are very strong, but so too is economics, as well as our Mendoza College of Business for undergrads is always ranked among the top five in the country. History, people would be surprised that we do cancer research here. We don't have a medical school, we don't have a health sciences center, but do quite a bit of cancer research. And astrophysics and nanotechnology are also very strong.
And that was the radiology building that I went by? Was that connected?
That's the radiation laboratory, and that does a wide variety of things under a federal government grant, but it's not necessarily connected to the astrophysics.
So pre-med, where do they go on to go to med school typically, or is there a typical?
We do have a very strong pre-med program. About 75% of our students are accepted to medical school, which is well above the national average. And so this is a good place to get your start and then move on to one of the great medical schools in the country.
Back to football and the stadium, and there's some anomalies there that one would not expect.
Yeah, it was built in 1930. Rockne had so much success in the 20s that he was able to convince the university to build a stadium as opposed to basically it was a field that they played on where the library is now. It was modeled on the University of Michigan, the Collegiate Bowl, smaller, and seated about 60,000. Rockne only coached in it for 1 year. He was killed in a plane crash in March of 1931.
So where was he going?
He was on his way to Hollywood.
Oh, wow.
He was an entrepreneur, great motivational speaker, and he was going to be doing some commercials out there and possibly a film. The plane crashed near Bazaar, Kansas, with 8 people on board, I believe. It was a national tragedy, actually. The funeral was on national radio. The president issued a statement. Rockne was one of the really massive figures of the time. But then the stadium was expanded in 1994. 7 was the first year that we played in it and expanded, and then we added some elements to it about 5 years ago, attached buildings to it for student life, for classrooms, for laboratories, for music. So now it's a place where it's used hundreds and hundreds of times a year instead of 8 to 10 times a year.
And there's some anomalies there. You won't see big billboard advertisements. How did that not happen?
Yeah, we have no advertising in any of our athletic arenas, unlike virtually every other college and professional organization, athletics organization. Our feeling is that we want as clean a collegiate environment as we can without the commercialization. So we don't have luxury boxes per se, and we don't have advertising either in signage or on the video board.
A lot of people ask me, are all the students Catholic?
Yeah, about 80%, 80 to 85%, it fluctuates a little bit, of our students are Catholic. And then we have probably about 12 to 15% are Protestant. But we have Jewish students, Muslim students, and we have students of no faith. All are welcome here. There's absolute academic freedom for faculty and students to pursue areas of inquiry that are of interest to them. And so very much like any other university in the country, we do have a faith component to it, though, and it's very strong. And it's unusual. Many of the great universities in the country, many of our peers began with a religious affiliation, but that fell by the wayside. Notre Dame has maintained its Catholic identity throughout.
An aside, there's a historic connection with the Green Bay Packers in Notre Dame.
Yeah, actually, Curly Lambeau was a student at Notre Dame, a football player, and he went on to be a part of the Green Bay Packer organization, and of course the Packers' home stadium is named Lambeau Field. And
capacity of your stadium is?
It's fluctuated. It's gone from about 60,000 up to about 81,000, and now it's at about 78,000, including the premium seats that we have. And for many years, sold out. I think for about 50 years in a row, we sold out. We lost that streak a couple of years ago, and then obviously during COVID, it went by the wayside. But it's pretty well packed every week. Every weekend in the fall with fans from all across the country. We're very much a national university with students from all 50 states and over 100 countries worldwide.
All said and done, is there one outstanding element that you're most proud of at Notre Dame here?
Well, I think for me personally, it was the opportunity to work with Father Theodore Hesburgh, who was Notre Dame's president from 1952 to 1987, 35-year tenure, one of the great leaders in higher education in the Catholic Church, but also nationally and internationally. He was a charter member of the Civil Rights Commission, played an active and prominent role in the writing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and just an incredible human being who passed away about 5 or 6 years ago at age 97, but a real honor to have worked with him. And just to work at Notre Dame and see the Golden Dome every day walking into work, it's pretty special.
And the graduates of Notre Dame are called?
Graduates of Notre Dame are called Domers. The Golden Dome is arguably the most famous collegiate landmark in the world. People see it on Saturday afternoons from the blimp over Notre Dame Stadium. It shines brightly, and we really enjoy having the opportunity to work underneath it.
I got a little box of chocolates as a gift from the university yesterday, and they're shaped in little domes.
Right. The South Bend Chocolate Company, which is a great business here in town, has created a Notre Dame series, and the Domers are a part of that.
Before we go, I understand that you were here when they filmed the movie Rudy, and you knew Rudy?
Rudy was filmed in 1992 here on campus. Dan Rudiger, Rudy, persevered and finally made his way into Notre Dame. He transferred from Holy Cross College, a junior college across the street. And
describe a little deeper on the anomaly of Rudy being so small.
Rudy was not a big guy. He was very short and stocky and would not be your prototypical Notre Dame football player. Anybody who's seen the movie has seen the differences, and they're real. Sean Astin played Rudy, and he was quite small compared to the other actors in the movie, and Rudy was the same way in real life. He persevered, he played, in his last, the only game he ever appeared in, he sacked the quarterback and was carried off the field, and he somehow got his life story made into a movie. His perseverance to make the football team is only outshone by his perseverance to get a movie made about his life.
And then he's a inspirational speaker today, right?
Yeah, he does a lot of motivational speaking around the country. I know that even still now, 30 years later, high school teams, even some college teams will watch the movie before a big tournament or a big game. And it is a great story of perseverance, of never giving up.
It really is. It can bring tears to your eyes.
Yes, it definitely can. And, Rudy, you got to give him a lot of credit for pushing through on that.
Before we go, if somebody wants to learn more about Notre Dame, where would you direct them?
Our website is nd.edu, and we have feature stories, news stories, and anything you need to know about applying to the university as a student. And we have social media accounts on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram.
And I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from the legendary University Notre Dame in South Bend, Indiana. We'll see you here. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer, reporting from South Bend, Indiana. The Studebaker family started their trajectory as a seminal icon of American automobile manufacturers back in 1852, when the Studebaker brothers started a South Bend, Indiana blacksmith shop. In 1902, the brothers introduced a line of electric vehicles, and Studebaker remained as an iconic and sometimes trend-setting manufacturer until the mid-1960s, when Studebaker's last hurrah was the classic Avante, crafted by legendary industrial designer Raymond Loewy. The Avante, unveiled in 1962, remains as a timeless, treasured, mid-century modern work of manufacturing art. Come along and join Maria Drevet, program manager at the South Bend, Indiana Studebaker National Museum. Maria Drevet?
Drevet.
Okay, yep. There you go. Little French roots there?
I believe so. It's my husband's last name, and they are think it's French, but they also are people that are just like, eh, we don't care. Yeah. We are at the Studebaker Museum here in South Bend, Indiana.
This is the home of Studebaker.
Yes, this is where they're from.
Going back to wagon days, right?
Going back to wagon days, the company, depending on how you declare its founding, started here in 1852.
And they were cutting edge, early developers of the automobile, right?
They were definitely one that saw that's where the future was going. Mm-hmm. So they decided to, you know, start investing in that carriage area, even as they were building wagons at the same time. At one point in their history, they were building gas cars, electric cars, and wagons all at the same time.
Oh, wow.
Just to cover all your bases.
So they had electric cars, kind of like the Baker.
Yes, early electrics.
Like 1912?
1912, 1907, kind of all those early eras, early 1900s.
Really cool.
Yeah.
So here we're at the museum,
and
you have an array of everything we talked about and more.
Yes, we start with the Studebaker's Conestoga they took here to South Bend up through the last car produced by Studebaker in Canada in 1966.
Oh, wow.
We cover all of that, and then, you know, along the way, a smattering of prototypes from Studebaker's history, some other pieces talking about some other parts of local industrial history, but we kind of cover the width and breadth of Studebaker's. Another example of just how much industry was based in South Bend. Studebaker wasn't some like random company in this town with nobody else. There was Singer Sewing Machine. Most of their cabinet boxes were made in South Bend at one point. If you wanted something built, chances were there was a company in South Bend building it.
Oh, interesting. How did Studebaker come to be here?
The family had been in Ohio and decided to make the move to South Bend just for economic opportunities. South Bend really was at a crossroads at the point. Traffic coming down from up in Michigan, traffic coming across from Chicago. It was beginning to be kind of the crossroads of America. So Studebaker was kind of at the center of it. So that's just where they settled. And then the family just really fell in love with the area and really decided to continue investing in the community from the company and from the different civic projects they took on over time.
Their last hurrah, as you alluded to, around mid-60s, that's period of the advent of the Avante.
Yes, the Avante. Studebaker's last designed automobile introduced in 1963, kind of as a last attempt to get some momentum going for the company. Didn't work as well as they would have hoped, only was built for 1963 or in 1964, but today is still kind of a quintessential mid-century modern design. Whenever they have, I believe in, there's a city in California, they always do like a mid-century week, and there's always Studebakers parked in front of the mid-century houses because the Avantes just fit perfectly those mid-century modern houses.
And the designer of the Avante was probably a foremost product design of the 20th century.
So Raymond Loewy and Raymond Loewy and Associates would take on that design process. Depending on who you ask, it's probably one of his guys that designed it, not him. But he knew when to spot talent and made full use of that to get this Avante designed in a very short time frame.
And as I recall, he designed the modern Coke bottle.
Yes. Once again, it's how much is hearsay, how much is he's claimed it, and he was not afraid just to use a little bit of self-promotion. But he has definitely designs like that, some train designs, a pencil sharpener that I know people like, and then, of course, several other Studebakers, including, like, the Starliner design, are attributed to Raymond Loewy.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So what happened? Why did Studebaker fold?
It's a very complicated question. One could probably point to a myriad of reasons, but at the end of the day, Studebaker was a diversified corporation by the 60s, and all their other parts of the portfolio made money, but cars didn't. So they eased out of the car market. The South Bend plants were closed in December of 1963. The Canadian plant in Hamilton, Ontario was kept open until 66. So they did slowly ease out of that automotive field. But it depends on who you ask. It depends on which factors you're looking at. But at the end of the day, it didn't save them. So
what happened to the Studebaker enterprise post-automobile?
Slowly sold off bits and bobs like corporations. So slowly dissolved away until you can't find any record of any Studebaker corporations.
Are there Studebaker family people still live around here?
A few. After the first generation of Studebaker brothers in the company, there would be a few involved with the company throughout its history, but never quite in like the president capacity.
Right.
So there'd be a few involved, but not as many. Because there was the five boys and five girls, and a lot of them didn't have kids, so there really are less lines of the family than there were in the local area. However, there's lots of Studebakers. If you go to the Ohio area, the Studebaker family has their own museum there. They have a big family reunion every 4 years, I think, and there's several hundred of them that get together every year. So,
but none that live in South Bend?
We know a few, but there's not, you know, what you would think from having five boys. There's not as many people as you'd think. We don't have a, you know, conglomeration of them.
Yeah. Give us a word picture of where we're at and what is here at the museum.
You're just going to see some beautiful craftsmanship from that wagon period up through that automobile period.
And how many vehicles do you have here?
People always say there's less, but there's definitely over 100. They were not afraid of colors, so cars of every color, all original paint colors, so we don't go off the books, but they believed in color. About over 100 vehicles spread across three floors, anything from a military collection to cars from the 1950s on, usually some sort of special exhibition talking about a particular part of the car world. But if you like a certain kind of automobile from, you know, 1920 through 1966, we probably have a design you'll like.
And back to military, World War II, what did Studebaker manufacture?
They manufactured B-17 bomber engines. They manufactured the Weasel, which is this treaded vehicle. It also came in an amphibious version. And then they made some half-ton trucks, usually under the U.S. 6 designation. Mm-hmm. So those three products were what they built during the war. All civilian production for a lot of companies completely ceased.
All here at South Bend?
Yep, all here in South Bend. So they had a plant south on kind of the south side of town that did a lot of lane engine building. And then the other work was spread across some various other spots. But yep, all that production here in South Bend during the World War II era.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
To learn more about your world, Maria.
To learn more, we have a website, studiobakermuseum.org. Of course, you can visit us here in South Bend. We're open most days throughout the year. And then, of course, we have social media channels and a slowly but surely growing YouTube video collection, so you can check out some history even if you can't make it in.
And the website again?
studiobakermuseum.org. And my name is Maria Gervet.
Maria, thank you so much.
Of course.
This has been a great morning. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from the Studebaker Museum in South Bend, Indiana.
Indiana Dunes National Park skirts along the southern shore of Lake Michigan and encompasses 15,000 acres of trails, kayak marshes, wetlands, and forest. The park is ranked among the top 5 birding destinations in North America. There are trails leading up to Mount Baldy, a 125-foot-tall living dune shaped by glacial sands. A bonus of a visit to the dunes are the 5 futuristic homes maintained by the National Park Service that were barged across Lake Michigan at the conclusion of the 1933 Chicago World's Fair. Come along and join National Park Ranger Rocky Wilkinson to discover the rest of the story about one of America's most visited national parks. Carl Sandburg once said, "The dunes are to the Midwest what the Grand Canyon is to Arizona and Yosemite is to California. They constitute a signature of time and eternity. The loss would be irrevocable."
Next up, we'll meet Julie Zasada, Executive Director with Cedar Lake Historical Association, that maintains the classic Old Lassen's Resort that's been repurposed as a museum and special event venue. Zasada is joined by Ted Rita, General Manager of the LaPorte, Indiana-based Heston Steam Museum, operators of a classic circa 1915 steam-powered boat that takes visitors for time travel cruises on Cedar Lake.
My name is Rafi Wilkinson. I'm a National Park Ranger here at Indiana Dunes National Park, which is located on the southern tip of Lake Michigan, about an hour to the east of Chicago.
We were just on the top, right?
Right, Mount Baldy. It's kind of our namesake dune, which is near Michigan City. It's 125 feet or so of just sand, more sand than most people have ever seen.
And what a killer day. There was Chicago's skyline clear as a bell.
Yeah, the lake is very dynamic, and you know, some days it's, of course, shrouded in fog or clouds, but today we got very lucky. It was really low humidity, and we could see Chicago 40 miles to the southwest, and we actually were able to see up the Michigan coastline probably 40 or 50 miles well into the state of Michigan.
Clear as a bell. Loved it.
Yeah, it was.
Talk to us about the history of the National Park site and what you're most proud of. What makes it distinctive and unique?
This park was founded in 1966, but actually, you know, there's been a 100-year struggle at what to do with this part of the world, this shoreline. And so actually we have a state park that was originally going to be a national park, nearly 100 years old. World War I and other things got in the way. But then after World War II, again, there was, what are we going to do with this land? And there was a big compromise where we have a steel mill, but we also now have what was originally a national lakeshore that would become renamed in 2019 to become a national park. It's a really special place. It's an urban park, but still has really amazing natural features. And, you know, probably what we're most known for is that we're the fifth most biodiverse of all the national parks. We're more biodiverse than, say, the Everglades or places in Hawaii, with nearly 2,000 species of life jammed into this little 15,000-acre sliver.
That's really cool. And avian, your bird flyway here, that's really incredible.
Yeah, and it's definitely known for that. We sit within the Mississippi and Lake Michigan flyway system. Basically, these birds, as they're flying north and south for migration, they look for large land features. And obviously, Lake Michigan is a perfect navigational guidance. And when they either are coming north and they get to the southern tip, they stop and rest. Or as they're coming south, once again, and they get to the southern tip, they'll stop. And so we're in the top five of national parks as far as birding. And we have a wonderful festival every spring in May where we'll see over 200 species of birds in 4 days. Yeah, it's a really special place for birding.
And again, it's one of the youngest national parks.
You know, we were a national lakeshore for over 50 years, and in 2019 there was a bill in Congress that authorized our name change. It is an aspect of the National Park Service overall where the name recognition of being a national park brings a lot more visitors. You know, internally, there's 423 national park units. Really, they're all deserved, I feel, of the name National Park. You know, Cuyahoga was renamed, White Sands was renamed, the Arch in St. Louis was renamed, we've been renamed.
It is really interesting how default a National Historic Site or a monument, it doesn't have that panache, that...
Not to the public.
And,
I think there's 28 different names of those 423, which the commonality is, of course, the Arrowhead, our patch. And you're right,
it's perception, isn't it?
It's perception is so much more. We ourselves, you know, we sit right next to interstates, you know, 94, 90, 80. And we get visitor after visitor that said, yeah, we used to drive by you all the time. You know, we were on the East Coast and we'd go make our big summer vacation out west and we'd drive by you. But now that our name changed to National Park, they stop and they love it. You know, they realize it. But yeah, it took the name change to make these people stop.
Talk to us about your demographics, where people typically come from to visit you. It seems to me that Chicago would be a big draw.
I did a quick analysis and there's more than 30 million people that live within 3.5-hour drive of us. So we're actually the closest national park to Detroit, to Chicago, to Milwaukee. St. Louis has the Arch, but of a more natural place, Indianapolis. So you're right, we can pull a ton of people in locally. Again, because of our location on the interstate system, we do have a very large swath.
Talk to us about a surprising aspect, and that's the architectural history here that dovetails back to the 1930s and a world exhibition.
So if we rewind the clock to the 1920s, there was an expansion of communities out this way. It was before the national parks, and obviously people wanted to live on the lakefront, and in particular there was a town now called Beverly Shores, and there was an opportunity in the early 30s after the end of the Chicago World's Fair of 1933 where different structures, homes were being sold, and the land developer here, the Bartletts, were in trouble. That was after the Great Depression. They needed people to come hopefully buy land from them, and they brought originally 16 structures over from the World's Fair, and there's six of them left. Five of them are owned by the National Park, and so these five homes sit right on Lake Michigan.
And these were future homes, right?
Yeah, a lot of them were to showcase future technologies. You know, one of them is completely made of metal, the Armco Ferro, and was designed to be an affordable sort of prefab house. There was a house made out of a new type of concrete called the Rostone House, and maybe most notably there was a called the House of Tomorrow, which was a floor-to-ceiling windowed house. It had a hangar. They thought that every American was going to have a small airplane at their disposal, and so it really kind of showcased what was going to be the future.
A Jetson home of
the home really was, yeah.
Talk to us about environmental diversity throughout the seasons. I mean, very different world here in the middle of the winter.
Yeah, we definitely are a four-season park, and there's a lot of parks that kind of shutter in the winter, but we do not. We're definitely a four-season park. We offer programming throughout that, and we do, as I said, see all four seasons from, you know, like last February, the lake froze over, you know, where you would see ice to the horizon, and it truly was an Arctic landscape. And today when we were up, we saw people swimming in the lake below us, and so we do get that. We have a very good fall season with color. We have a great wildflower season in the spring that comes up, and we have these big expansive times of lupins, these great purple flowers that permeate throughout our oak savannas. We definitely have good hot summer weather. We just came off a week of really classic August Midwest heat.
Talk to us about where people stay in the local communities when they come to visit the park.
One of the interesting things, you know, we're a very urban park, there's no doubt about it, and so we do have a ton of nearby communities. So whether or not you want to camp, you know, the state park has a campground, we have a national park campground. There are four or five other campgrounds in the area that they obviously host visitors to us. There's B&Bs, and certainly there is a large hotel network between Michigan City and Chesterton and Valparaiso and Portage and Gary. You know, there's places to stay. So people do not have an issue. Like a lot of times if you're going to go to a very remote park out west where lodging could be an issue and you're hours and hours away, there is plenty of lodging, of restaurants, of amenities, you know, right next to the park. Closest sister park would be Sleeping Bear,
and that's up in Michigan.
In Michigan, it's up near the, it's on obviously on Lake Michigan, but Sleeping Bear National Lakeshore is a wonderful park and is like us, but obviously different looking, but obviously protects the shoreline of Lake Michigan as well.
But they have a comparable sand dune, right?
They do very much, and it's a different system. They started with a large bluff formation, and the sand has now been blown up over it. So their dunes are actually taller than ours. Mm-hmm. But if you were to cut through theirs, you'd see that there's earth up where ours are 150 feet of pure sand. So it's a different topology. But yeah, there's a great sand dune up there, great camping up there. They also have two islands in Lake Michigan, North and South Manitou Island, which offer a really unique experience to go out and actually camp. And then North Manitou is our closest federal wilderness area, where there's truly, you know, you camp anywhere you want, but you have to bring everything over because there's no camp store to help you out, and it's on a ferry, and so you have to be careful of storms or you may get caught an extra day until the storm clears. But yeah, great place. And obviously you keep going north and Pitchard Rock and Apostle Islands, and you know, so the Great Lakes were part of that cluster of parks.
If somebody wanted to learn more about your world, where would you direct them?
We're part of the National Park Service website system, which is nps.gov. Or, you know, really the best way is if you Google search Indiana Dunes National Park, you know, that website is going to come up. And my name is Rafi Wilkinson with Indiana Dunes National Park.
Rafi, thank you so much. What a wonderful day exploring the park.
Thank you so much.
Right.
I'm Julie Zazada. I'm the executive director of the Cedar Lake Historical Association, which operates the museum at Lassen's Resort on the shores of Cedar Lake.
And I'm Ted Rita. I run the Heston Steam Museum, which is a museum of all kinds of steam artifacts. And our job is to really illustrate and teach our guests what steam power did for the world, how it improved the quality of life globally.
Talk to us for a moment about the steam-powered boat that you have operational that takes people out on rides on the lake. That's really cool.
I partnered with the Heston Steam Museum and Ted's operation in order to recreate what's called the Dewey Line. The Lassen's Resort had a fleet of steamboats that would ferry passengers back and forth from their resort to the Monon Railroad Depot, which sat on the edge of Cedar Lake shoreline. And so when Ted came to visit and saw that piece of history, he got a little bit excited because he knew of a way that we could recreate that experience.
This pier would have been Lassen Brothers Pier, and it would have been 100 feet further out into the water on pilings. We would have had a dance floor that we could dance with 1,000 of our closest friends. We would have had a buffet restaurant that we could...
My name is Jeremy Bevan, interpretive naturalist with Charlestown State Park, Indiana State Parks.
And we're pretty close to Louisville, Kentucky, huh?
We're just upstream, about 14 miles.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about what's so special about this place.
Charlestown State Park is pretty unique. We're a young property. This was actually an Army ammunition plant from the World War II era. And of course, before that, it was farmland, as well as a resort that we had here called Rose Island.
That's what I'm so fascinated with.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about Rose Island and its beginnings and endings.
Yeah, so Rose Island actually started out known as Fern Grove, which was a park that was designed for the local churches to come get out of the city and get back into nature and have
was
a day.
It late 1800s?
Yes, yeah, 1880s, mm-hmm. In fact, was when it first opened up. The churches would come up here for a day in nature, get the fresh air, just get away from the city. Mm-hmm. They did open it up to other organizations, and it did become a place for the general public as well. But yeah, it was a very popular place, pretty simple in those days. They did build a small hotel. They had a dance hall as well as a dining hall. But that was really the extent of Fern Grove.
And it was pretty much riverboat transportation for getting here and back.
Absolutely. And that's really what was the main reason to start it, was you had a company in Louisville that operated steamboats hauling freight. Mm-hmm. But the railroad had really overtaken their industry. So they were just looking for a way to keep those boats profitable and thought if they could make this park up in a natural setting along the river that they could charge people to go.
Tell us about the two classic riverboats, and the one is still operating and tied up in Louisville.
Right, yeah. So there was a couple boats that brought people up. And the most well-known was the Idlewild, actually later renamed the Avalon, and then eventually it became known as the Belle of Louisville. So it's the oldest operating steamboat in the world.
It's like 109
years old? Yeah, just about to turn 110, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. And then there was another steamboat called the America, and it was actually much larger than the Belle of Louisville, could hold much more people. It actually met its end in the river due to fire, though, as many steamboats did.
Let's talk about the era of Rose's Resort. It included a roller coaster.
The park eventually was put up for sale, and a businessman from Louisville named David Rose bought it in 1923 and really turned it into more of a resort. They did have a small roller coaster, a carousel. They had a shooting gallery. You know, like if you go to the fair today, the kids have squirt guns and they can shoot at targets to win a prize. Here, they were actually given 22 caliber rifles to show their marksmanship to win a prize.
That's really cool. Yeah. And then you had cabins and a dance hall.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the other cool
infrastructure. Yeah, so cabins along the riverbank that you could rent. You could stay in those all summer even, and many people did that. They did have a dance hall, which in the daytime was actually a roller skating rink. Mm-hmm. And then while the guests were having dinner, the staff would put down a fresh coat of wax for an evening of dancing.
And the cabins?
Yeah, the cabins were pretty impressive. They had actually had running water, which was a huge deal in those days. They had a bathroom with a shower and toilet.
Indoor plumbing.
Yeah, the indoor outhouse, as they said. Yeah. Uh-huh. And then they actually had kitchens with a cook stove and a refrigeration ice box. Again, you know, you were in the middle of nowhere at this time. You were in nature. To have those modern comforts was certainly quite a special
thing. And Mr. Rose put in his own power plant out here?
He did, yeah. Before he came along, the site was pretty rustic and had no electricity, but he had a small power plant built on site to allow him to install all those modern features.
And he even had a zoo.
They did have a small zoo with a few animals on display, including monkeys, wolves. The star attraction, of course, was a black bear known as Teddy Roosevelt.
One of the interesting things about history, it's all myth, legend, and lore, and some archival, but you managed to meet a guy that worked here as a kid.
Yeah.
That must have been priceless.
Absolutely. You know, before I met him, my tour would be about an hour, and he almost doubled it because he lived it. He actually lived in the hotel with his family for a few years. So just amazing. And, you know, it's one of those places where it's history, right? Mm-hmm. And we see these pictures and these stories, and never in my wildest dreams did I expect someone from those photos, from those stories, to show up.
Tell us about the flood, because that's what wiped out a lot of the physical evidence of this resort.
Yeah, unfortunately, being on the river, they had many prosperous years, but in 1937, we saw the most devastating flood that's ever been seen in this part of the country.
Mind-blowing. You have some markers up in the trees.
Yes.
You can't even comprehend how humongous that flood was.
Right,
yeah. You said it was a 500-year flood?
Yeah, it's what they would call a 500-year flood. It was January of 1937. They had 2 weeks of nonstop rainfall. You know, had nowhere to go. So it flooded much of Louisville. Over 60% of the city was underwater at one point there as well.
Sadly, the odds are strong that it could happen again.
Yeah, definitely so. You know, flooding is becoming more common, at least in our part of the country here. And those January, February floods are pretty predictable almost every year now.
And tell us again the name of the state park where we're at right now.
Yeah, so we are at Charlestown State Park. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think Charleston. No, we're Charlestown, mm-hmm. Charlestown State Park in southern Indiana.
So this park is operated by DNR of Indiana.
Yes, sir, Indiana Department of Natural Resources. Mm-hmm.
From evidence in our hiking today, one of the popular draws here would be hikers.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's really been our big draw, historically speaking. We have about 17 miles of trail, various difficulties, but that's been our main draw for many years. And then with the Rose Island site reopening in 2011, that's become our number one attraction, certainly. But a lot of hikers come out. In the springtime, we have amazing wildflower displays. We do full moon hikes every month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so that's a pretty popular guided hike we do here as well.
And bikers?
We don't have any mountain bike trails yet, but we get a lot of road bikers. Mm-hmm. Certainly see mountain bike trails in our future.
So where's your demographic primary draw other than Louisville?
It's really shifting. Historically, you know, the first 10-15 years, it was a lot of local people. Mm-hmm. It's really changed dramatically over the last few.
Think it's because of the word is getting out?
Or? That's a lot of it, yeah. Mm-hmm. People are figuring us out. Or we get a lot of people from Indianapolis area, northern Indiana now. But literally, I've had people on hikes with me from all over the world.
So right now, we're in the main lodge and interpretive center?
Yeah. So this is our store, our lodge, our nature center, office. It's all kind of a jack-of-all-trades building.
And you have T-shirts and sweatshirts over there.
Oh, yeah. We try to get some good souvenirs for folks. Mm-hmm. So you remember your experiences here.
I love come to the park side.
Yes, that's a good one.
I love it. So a little bit more what you're most proud of.
Well, Rose Island, certainly a very popular site. To me, the spring wildflowers are unbeatable here. So I always encourage people to come out here in the early springtime. We have a fantastic campground as well. I put our campground against any in the state.
Really?
Yeah. Big sites. Mm-hmm. We have full hookup sites, which are pretty in demand these days.
Yeah.
And those primitive sites just don't get used much.
Interesting.
Yeah. You know, when a lot of our campgrounds were first built, you had a station wagon and a tent. And now everybody has an RV.
Yeah. Backed in and put the tailgate up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now we're getting buses.
Mm-hmm. Well, to learn more about your world, do you have a...
Go to the Indiana DNR website, which is dnr.in.gov. Or, of course, if you're on Facebook, you can follow us at Charlestown State Park, and we do post all of our programs and events there pretty regularly. Again, I'm Jeremy Bevan. I'm the naturalist here at the park.
Jeremy, thank you for a wonderful hike this morning. This was really revealing.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure.
My name is Jeff Lane. I am the historian archivist of the French Lick Resort, which includes the French Lick Springs Hotel, as well as the West Baden Springs Hotel.
Try and encapsulate and compress a little bit of history. It's absolutely fascinating. I still have a hard time describing what I visually see there.
It's overwhelming. Being from French Lick originally, for me it's a dream come true to be in this position, to have always studied the history of the area, and to actually be a direct descendant of the first settler of the county. And I serve as county historian as well. But having this job after my retirement from elementary teaching and being able to do this fun job that just hardly seems like work at all, to see the variety of artifacts that are available and that people come in to see, literally the artifacts walk in. Mm-hmm. People bring us things.
That's really cool.
Oh, yeah, it is. They're so excited, you know, when they come here because they think, ah, I can bring something. I can leave something that belonged to a member of my family, and I can leave it here where I know it will be taken care of.
Let's roll back in time. It's 1902, and the new resort is opening. Give us the big picture. What is it?
First of all, it's the West Baden Springs Hotel. The fire, of course, that destroyed the original structure on June 14th, 1901. And here it is, June 14th of 1902. The hotel is built in less than a year. It contains the largest free-span dome in the entire world, built of steel, glass, and concrete. It's just, as they called it, the eighth wonder of the world.
And it remained as the world's largest free-span dome until the Houston Astrodome, is that correct?
That is absolutely correct. Now, there was a dome that was larger, built in Poland in 1913, but it was not built of steel, glass, and concrete. So that's the difference.
It's fascinating, too, that structurally, it's doing real well.
It is. And with the restoration of the building by the Cook Group, who are now the owners, by adding new structural steel, it's actually a stronger building than when it was built in 1902.
And I know there's no way to do verbal justice to such a visual scene, but try and describe that grand central space.
Wow, you're right. It's just this grand atrium. It's a free-span dome. No interior supports whatsoever. It's just massive.
How tall to the ceiling?
It's 110 feet from floor to ceiling. It's 200 feet in diameter. It's approximately 600 in circumference. It's just a massive space, and it's basically used as an extension of the main lobby. So it's just so much fun to just sit there and relax and just take it all in.
I've been relaxing there for 3 days, and I'm still trying to take it all in.
Absolutely. And I hope you've been there for the evening light show that's available, because
we had dinner down there last night.
Oh, absolutely. And to see the lights change in the center of the atrium as well as all the way around the edge, it's just incredible what has been done with the restoration, the amount of money that has gone into the restoration by a couple who truly are noted preservationists, and they just absolutely put their entire souls into that.
Let's roll back in time, 1902. This was cutting edge, state-of-the-art, full-service resort destination with multiple train daily service from Chicago.
We believe there were about 14 trains per day that came from the north, from basically Chicago. It was, of course, originally called the CI&L, which was the Chicago-Indianapolis-Louisville, which was later renamed the Monon Railroad. They just brought hordes of people. People were coming to West Baden and French Lick for their health. They were drinking the mineral water. Of course, each hotel had its own house physician. It was just fantastic. People came for not just a week, they might stay for months at a time. They said they came there to take the cure.
And that literally was one of your best hopes for survival back in the day, because that was pre-antibiotics and pre-all kinds of modern drugs we take for granted. You had Pluto water. Tell us about that.
Okay, the Pluto water was available at French Lick. Of course, the water at West Baden went by a different name. It was known as Sprudel water, and the word Sprudel translates in German to spring. And it was spring water, and it was said to cure almost any ailment that any guest came there with. And they would drink three times a day. The house physician would prescribe the waters. They would, of course, walk the paths and get plenty of exercise. It would make them feel like new people.
There was a secret ingredient in there.
There was a secret ingredient. We know for a fact in the Pluto water, the secret ingredient was lithium, and we're assuming it was the same ingredient at West Baden with the Sprudel water. And of course, if you're drinking that water, you are feeling wonderful. Nothing is hurting. You're feeling fantastic, and you can't get enough of it. And you're constantly wanting to come back and revisit those areas that you have such positive results.
The government kind of put an end to that water, didn't they?
Yes, they did. The government controlled that substance in 1971, and at that point, Pluto water was no longer able to be bottled.
Until that time, they were shipping it across the country. It was a major enterprise.
Absolutely. It was nationwide. I mean, train car after train car, loads of water. Every drugstore in the United States had Pluto water available. So everybody was getting it, whether they were traveling here or not. You could still buy the Pluto water, and they loved it.
So this destination, both resorts, attracted mafia, gangsters, right? Al Capone.
They did. Of course, we have no guest books that actually have his name written in them, but they attracted many, many people from the underworld, I guess, as we would call them. It was just important to get away from it all. If you were in the cities or you might be in trouble, you could come here to what we knew as the country, and nobody could find you. I mean, there were so many rural areas that you could hide out, and so they did.
But even the ones that weren't hiding out, there was illegal but open gambling throughout town, right? How many gambling houses were here?
We can definitely specifically say 9, but we know that there were more places that people were gambling besides those 9. Some of those are still standing, actually, have had other uses. Oh, yes, gambling, the illegal gambling, and it went on from about 1895, and finally in 1949, the governor of Indiana said, okay, we've had enough, it shouldn't continue, and that's when he put an end to the illegal gambling.
How interesting. But up until that time, implicit is that there was police force that knew what was going on, and yet...
Oh, absolutely. We have been told that the state police would actually call some people around in French Lick, probably the people who owned the casinos, and would say, well, we're coming down in a couple of weeks to raid you. And of course, that gave them plenty of time to put everything away. We didn't call them casinos in those days. We called them supper clubs. And so you would dine, and then you would move into another room where you would actually play and have your cards or your equipment to roll the dice and the roulette wheels and all sorts of gambling apparatus.
And back in the day, there was another dynamic, and this place attracted professional baseball teams for spring training, correct?
Absolutely. Chicago Cubs, the White Sox. Both hotels had their own baseball teams and would compete against these professional teams that would come here for spring training.
That's really cool.
Oh, it's fantastic. Just to think of all of the people who have been here. It was definitely a place for the elite to come. The celebrities of the day would come here. One time we do know that Howard Hughes and Lana Turner flew in to the French Lick Airport just for the day, just to be seen at French Lick, because it was really the thing to do in those days.
And there's more. You have presidents have stayed here.
Absolutely.
Tell us about some of the characters.
Okay, for instance, the 1931 Governors Conference was held here. We have pictures of all of the governors. Franklin Roosevelt and Eleanor are in that picture as well. We've had presidents. We've had Ronald Reagan when he was governor. Harry Truman. Just numerous presidents and well-knowns from the time. Absolutely.
And the one resort hotel hit some hard times, didn't it?
Yes, it did. The West Baden Springs Hotel hit a very hard time in 1929, of course, due to the Depression. And finally, it was forced to close in 1932. Then, at that time, the owner began searching for someone who could use a structure that massive.
They found the Jesuits.
He did. He was finally put in contact with the religious group known as the Society of Jesus, the Jesuits, and he donated it to that group for $1, which was probably the price to record the deed at the courthouse. It became a Jesuit seminary then from 1934 through 1964, and it became a place where students came to become priests. The priests, of course, were the teachers, and then the brothers did all of the other work that was necessary.
And then they went away, and it became a college.
Yes, they then sold out because there were not as many students becoming priests at that point. Then it was sold at auction to a couple in Michigan, and they donated the property at West Baden to Northwood Institute, which was a private liberal arts college, and they offered degrees in automotive marketing, hotel and restaurant management, performing arts, education courses. So it had another life from that time until 1983, when Northwood Institute closed.
And then what happened?
Then it became vacant. A local man purchased the property, hoping to restore it, we believe, much like the Cooks have done, but his finances ran out, and so it really fell into disrepair. An outer section of rooms collapsed. So it was basically vacant for 13 years while it was tied up in legal court in California.
And now, Renaissance.
Ah, Renaissance. Now we get to see it come alive again. And that is truly what it has done with the Cooks. They have brought it back to life. They began in 1996 with a partial restoration. They were actually planning to restore the public areas, the lobby, the atrium, and the dining room, to make the property more marketable. No one came forth to purchase the property. And so at that point, the Cooks thought, well, okay, let's keep it ourselves. Let's start fixing up the guest rooms, and let's go in the hotel business. And so that's what they did at West Baden. They also purchased the French Lick Springs Hotel, which was in great need of many, many repairs. And so now they own it all.
And Mr. Cook is gone, but the Cook Family Trust still runs and operates everything.
Yes. Mrs. Cook is still living, as well as their son Carl, who is very involved in the projects that go on. We feel like we're very, very safe because we know that the Cooks care so much about the property. So we're just thrilled to see all of the projects that they have created and the restoration work that continues to this day.
My understanding is that Mr. Cook, the patriarch, he earned his wealth by inventing the heart stent, is that true?
Yes, they began in 1963, he and Mrs. Cook, in a two-bedroom apartment in Bloomington, Indiana, making heart stents, wire guides, and catheters for heart surgeries. So they are in that business and continue to be in that business to this day and have several companies throughout the entire world. but then they have branched out, as you can plainly see, with what they have done here in our valley.
To learn more about your world, do you have a website? A go-to?
You can go to frenchlick.com, and that can tell you all sorts of information about our resort and the different amenities that we have available. And my name is Jeff Lane, and I am the historian archivist of the entire French Lick Resort.
And a direct descendant of the first pioneers in the county.
Yes, I'm a direct descendant of the first settler in the county who came here in 1807, who actually lived in a cave for a short time until his log cabin could be built, and he was a Quaker from North Carolina.
Awesome. Thanks again, Jeff. This has been great.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, I'm your host, Tom Wilmer. We'll see you at French Lick in Indiana.
You've been listening to the travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station. I listen to WNYC in New York, and in fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.